And now I'd like to go ahead and welcome our main speaker, Georgia B. from L.A.
Hi, everyone. My name is Georgia. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here and to be sober. Thank you, Kristen, for inviting me. Everybody's been so lovely and made me feel so welcome, and I appreciate that. And there's a few people I know in the room tonight, which is really fun. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, the world has become a much smaller place to me. You know, wherever I go, I have friends. And that feels really good, and it's made the world really small. Even when I've traveled outside of the country, because of this program, we have this shorthand, and we connect with people so much more easily. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you, Jason, for coming with me. He has not heard my talk before, so if he gets up and leaves, you can understand why. No, it's not that bad, really. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. I got sober when I was 24 and a half. And so I've been sober 25 years, which is kind of a big deal. And that's been my theme this year whenever I share, you know, it's like I'm 25, which is kind of a big deal, because it is. But however long you're sober is a big deal. But for me, it was especially so because I can break down my life into the two halves. There's the first half of my life where everything I did was based on how I felt. I was driven by my emotions. Every decision I made was based on how I felt. Whereas in the last 25 years, I've been taught to take actions based on what the next right thing is to do, which normally isn't goes in the same line as my feelings. And it's been at a series of taking contrary actions, taking sponsor direction. You know, no matter how long I'm sober, I'm never ever going to be able to see my whole picture. So I'll never see this, whether I'm 20, 30, 40. So I always need a sponsor to who can see my whole picture. And I've always had sponsors who saw more in me than I saw in myself and believed I could do more than I thought I could. And as a result, I've had really just a magnificent life, and I'm grateful for that. I don't remember when I had my first drink, but I found a picture recently with my dad, and he is tipping a beer stein back in my mouth. And I was 11 months old in the picture, so I'm like, there's my first drink, because everybody talks about their first drink and what a powerful thing it was. And I'm like, oh, I don't remember my first drink. So then I was like, yes, there it is. But I don't remember really my first drink. I kind of just tapered on, because by the time I was 11, I was arrested for drinking in public. So it was a problem early on. My dad died of cancer when I was 6, and I ran wild. My mom worked 3 jobs to support us, and she was more or less depressed and angry all of the time. And her life was spent going to work, and then she'd come home. She worked 2 jobs every day, and then she'd come home from work and sit in front of the television and smoke her more menthol cigarettes and cuss at the world, cuss at the TV. And I would maybe come in and say something like, hello, and she would say, not now! You know, just at me saying hello. She was already at a 10. And I was a lonely kid. I don't remember a time when I was young that I didn't have these huge emotions. Those always existed for me. I feel like I was born singing the blues, you know, from a really young age. My emotions were so big. And so I was constantly looking to try and understand what life was about and what this madness was about and to feel loved. And I couldn't articulate it at the time, but I had this sense that if somebody loved me, I'd be okay. And I liked my mom. She was funny and charismatic sometimes, but most of the time, she was really angry, lonely, and depressed. And so I started to find my love in other places. And that was with the older kids in the neighborhood. I was about the height I am now in elementary school, which is sort of a bummer. And the kids came up with a nickname for me, which was BFU, and it stood for Big, Fat, and Ugly. And yeah, that was a harsh name. And it's really hard to shake those old ideas about yourself. And so that's not what I was going for. And then in junior high, the kids came up with a nickname for me based on the size of my lips, which I will not repeat tonight. But people pay to get their lips done now, so. But but I remember trying to pretend like they were little, like I'd tuck them in. But then as soon as I start drinking, I'm like, bleh, bleh, bleh. Anyway. But so, you know, early on, I'm hooking up with the older kids in the neighborhood. I'm smoking, I'm drinking, I'm stealing my mom's car. At that time, she had a Buick Wildcat, which is this massive 8-cylinder vehicle that I would cruise around the neighborhood, hubcaps flying, hitting things, you know. Might go back and get it, might not. I'm not sure. It depends on what's going on. I was the kid in the neighborhood you don't want your kid hanging out with. As I said, my mom worked really hard, so our house was overrun. Like, it was, our house was crazy, and our yard was the yard in the neighborhood that brought the cost of your house down. And so I was really ashamed of that. And so to overcompensate for that, I tried to be perfect, because if I was perfect, then maybe somebody would love me and I'd be okay. And so I, you know, showered 3 times a day. I feathered my hair like Farrah. If you don't know who Farrah is, Google her. Her hair was fabulous. So I feathered my hair like Farrah. You know, I always tried to look and be perfect, and, you know, yet it nothing really was. I just thought somehow if I was, then people would love me and it would be okay. I mean, really, that was the theme of everything. And I felt bad for my mom, and I wanted to be closer to her. I didn't know how, and I took on all of her hurts and her pains and her angers without having the experience that she had. So a lot of what I felt, I couldn't understand at all, the pains that I felt and the sadness. And obviously, my dad dying at 6 was a traumatic experience in my life, but my emotions were bigger than that. And so when I started drinking, it was like an e-ticket, which is like old school Disney stuff, but an e-ticket out of the pain that I was in. And I would be at home, let's say, and I would have no idea what to do with myself. I'm like, I'm so bored. What do I want to do? I'm so lonely. So I knew if I could just get a few drinks in me, the answers would come, and they always did. I always came up with something to do, and that's what I would do. And so I went from being student body president in 6th grade to in 7th grade, dropping out of school and going to summer school to make it to the next grade. At 10 years old, I had a 16-year-old boyfriend, which is super creepy to think about. I see my friends with kids, and I can't even imagine that I thought I was so grown up at that time. But I looked like one on the outside, but inside I wasn't at all. And so, you know, at 11, I'm arrested for drinking in public. At 12, I had my first suicide attempt. At 13, I was pregnant, and I terminated that pregnancy at the urging of my mom and my boyfriend, and then I drank over that for years and years. And it wasn't until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I shared that experience with someone else that weight was lifted. You know, even with 25 years, which is kind of a big deal, things stay in a place of regret until I can either use that experience to help someone else or use that experience to change something that I'm going through. And but back then I didn't know that, and I was just collecting regrets. And my friend Charlie talks about driving through life in a big station wagon, and it's like, yeah, screw that, I'll deal with it later. You're just throwing all your regrets in the back of your big station wagon. Partying through life, and then you get sober, and it's if you throw on the brakes of that station wagon, and now all the stuff's right here. And that's what the steps help you sort through. But back then, I was just collecting all of that. And so at 13, I had my second suicide attempt, and I always drank like a pig. There was never a time I drank socially. I always drank because it was the one thing that made me feel better. But the problem was, is if one's good, like 10 or 15, probably better, but not really. And even the people I was hanging out with, I was drinking different. My drinking was different than my fellows that were also drinking the way I was drinking, you know what I mean? It was already so bad at that age, and I would have horrendous hangovers every time, but it never stopped me because the payoff was worth it to me, to have those moments of relief, to have the moments of joy, to have those moments where I felt like I fit in and where the world didn't seem so scary and I didn't feel so lost. And so the price, you know, you guys paid it, but I was cool. I mean, I paid it in a different way, but I didn't care who else suffered as long as I could ease some of that pain. My favorite show, Law and Order, but also Sex and the City. I watch it in rerun. I just love the girls. And, you know, the girls go out in their fabulous dresses, and they drink these beautiful cosmopolitans and flavored martinis, which I've never had. And, you know, they're dressed up and out, and they're talking about Mr. Big, and they're laughing. And so I watch these shows, and I'm like, oh, I bet I could do that. I bet I could do that. You know, maybe I, you know, maybe I'm not really that bad. And then quickly, I'm reminded that the way I drink is with a funnel and a hose. Like, that's how I drink. This never happened. Never. I was always drinking like a pig. I'm an old English 800 girl. I'm a 10 high whiskey Marlboro red box back. I could beer bong 5 beers at once, which I was really proud of. It took a lot of projectile vomiting, so sorry to those friends who were close. But I got really good at it, and those were the things I was proud of. I really took pride in, and I collected all the empty bottles, and I kept them on a shelf in my room, and maybe you'd come over, and I'd be like, huh? Huh? You know, just like, it was crazy that I would, like, full flight from reality. And probably about the time I got arrested, my mom threw up her hands and said, you know what, you're going to do whatever you're going to do anyway, I'd rather you do it here. So if you're going to drink, if you're going to smoke, do it here. And I take things really literally, so I'm like, cool. So I turned my room into a party room. So somebody would knock at the door, my mom would be watching TV after working her 2 jobs, and or maybe it's her 3rd job on the weekend, and she would be watching TV and be disrupted. So she'd say, who's scratching at the door? And one of my frightened friends would be like, is Georgia here? And she'd say, she's in the opium den, which is what she called my room. I've never done opium. I don't know if that's the right verb. Whatever you do with opium, I have never done. But I felt like I was kind of in the opium club because of the name of my room. But so I packed people into my room, and I would get booze by either stealing it, really good at that. I would buy the chaser, because that seemed fair. And then I would steal the booze. Everything I did, I really did feel justified for everything I did. My mom would say, we don't have any money. We were really poor. I work at the Midnight Mission now, so we weren't like that poor, like Skid Row poor, but we were poor compared to my friends. And so I would want cute clothes. I mean, chemendifers were the thing. I had to wear chemendifers or else I wouldn't fit in. And my mom would say, we don't have the money. So I'd go and I'd steal the clothes, and then I'd come home and show her, like just in her face. And I never thought about how that would make her feel, never really considered it. I just thought, how could she do this to me? You know, how could she not give me the money to get everything I need? I was so entitled and just never knew it. I just always felt like such a victim until I got to the 4th column of the 4th step, you know, and then I was able to really see who I was. But I always drank like a pig, and I consider myself an alcoholic. I believe I suffer with alcoholism, but for me, I believe that can get me wherever I'm weak. So it can be food, sex, money, drugs. My alcoholism is always looking for a way out. So another thing that I started really early on was at 13, I started starving myself, and at 17, I started throwing up. So I'd be skinny and perfect, so you'd love me, and then maybe I'd be okay. And I didn't get any recovery from that until I addressed my alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I mean by that is going to meetings, working with a sponsor, doing the steps, praying, working with new people, being of service. All of those things that we're taught to do here, if I simply do those things every single day, if that's my focus, friendship problems seem to resolve, finance problems seem to resolve, work problems seem to resolve, health problems maybe not so much, but I'm in a much better spiritual condition. Because today I know what's wrong with me, there's a solution. And it turns out there's one solution for all of my problems. It's this. It's always been this. I've tried some other solutions in sobriety and suffered a little bit longer than I needed to, but I do know that I can tap into joy if I just do those things at any time. But back then, I didn't know that. And so if it's going to make me feel different, it doesn't even really need to make me feel better, just different, I'm going to say yes. So oftentimes, you know, somebody would give me something, especially if it's free, then it's really good. And, you know, I'm the kind of girl, I take it. I'm like, what was that? I don't really care, just as long as it's going to change how I felt. So I went through a lot of different phases with drugs. And you know, today I have to work a really diligent program so there's no breach in security, because I really do believe my alcoholism is always looking for a way out, and it's not always going to show up in the form of a drink. It's like tonight, you've got to have a piece of that baklava. You've got to have it. I'm like, why would I have one? I want 6. So I say, no, thank you. So anyway, I have to work a diligent program. No breach in security. So that's kind of what my drinking was like. I was a teenage drinker, drinking with all my friends, in and out of school. I always hung out with the older kids. I really didn't hang out with anyone my age. I was back and forth to continuation. I wanted to graduate with my class, so that was important to me. So in my senior year, I got enough credits. I got 3 years of credits in 1 year, and I was given an award for doing what I should have done all along. I got like most improved, and there was a special dinner, and I got a little award, and was able to graduate with my class at my regular high school. And as soon as my mom knew I was gonna graduate, she was like, I'm out of here. She claimed bankruptcy and moved home to my grandmother, who I believe was the meanest human being who ever walked the planet. And so that was fine with me because I was really sick to death of having to be nice to this grandma. So I was raised believing that I had my mom and my grandma. There's just the three of us. We have to rely on each other. You can't trust anyone else. People are gonna hurt you. Life is gonna suck. You can't trust anyone. One day you're gonna have to work. You're gonna hate it. And so, like scared, and they were really unhappy, and I thought, this is not a good deal. This does not look good. And any long weekend, any summer, my mom and I would have to go to see my grandma, and then spend days in my grandma's house with my mom and grandma both smoking and in their house coats till like 3, watching brown TV and like Bonanza and stuff like that. And it was just horrible because I wanted to be with my friends partying, and I was dying. And then finally, we would go out, and they'd go to a bar and leave me locked in the car, and then they'd go. Then we'd all go to dinner, and then they'd drink and smoke at dinner, and they'd fight and hurt each other's feelings, and then they wouldn't speak, and then they'd translate through me, and then finally we'd go back to the house, and then my grandma would come in for a little talk. Now, my grandma would say that she was not an alcoholic, but she'd always have like a big old drink, like vodka punch. And she'd be like, you know, your grandma's not an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk. And I didn't know that those two words were the same thing, but now I have a thesaurus. And so I know that those are the same thing. So she would come in at the end of the night, and she would tell me that my mom was depressed and angry because of me, because she was stuck taking care of me, and how disappointed my dad would be if he were alive, and that I ruined her life, and by the way, your hair is stringy, the way you dress, blah, 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 just one thing after another. Then she would tell me that she was going to be dying soon too, which would really scare me. And I found out later that she started telling my mom that when my mom was 9 years old, and my grandma had her when she was 18. So my grandma died from the age of 27 until 90 when she actually died. I believe it's the longest death on record. I'm not sure. So she would tell me she was gonna die, and I'd just be laying there like, I'm a piece of crap, you're gonna die, what am I gonna do? And then she would say, you know, your grandma loves you, sweet dreams. Crazy. I mean, I did not know what to do. And so when my mom claimed bankruptcy and moved home to her mother, I was like, cool, cuckoo town is all contained. They can live with each other. And now I can live the way I've always wanted to, although I always had. I've, like I said, I've never had any rules. I've never been grounded. I've always run wild. Nobody's ever told me what to do. I've never sat down to eat dinner at a table at a normal time. Somebody said, you were a scrapper. I'm like, I was a scrapper. I don't think that's a compliment, but I was a scrapper. That's what I was. So I started working when I was 14, not to help with the household, but to get stuff for myself and to have money for myself. And so when I graduated from high school, I got a really great job straight out of high school, but I started having an affair with my married boss, which was another pattern that I had set up. Was a lot of overlapping, and I tended to go for men that I would call pre-screened. You had done the work, you had gotten to know them, so clearly they're okay. So they had been pre-screened. And really, I did not think, I still felt like a victim. I still felt like I had just had this really hard life, and you know, I deserved to be loved. And I lost that job, and I had to go to another job. And all the while, all these years that I'm trying to take care of myself, I'd been on my own since I was 17, I kept running my life into the ground, but I could start over. I had the energy, I could do it, I would start over. And then I would run my life into the ground, but I was getting more and more tired. And you know, in my early 20s, I felt so old, so much older than I am now, you know. And what happened was I had my last suicide attempt, and this time I had to have my stomach pumped. And at the time, my roommate had a brother who had a little problem with crack cocaine, But he was better now, but his wife just wouldn't accept that he was better. He hadn't been to a program. It was just some kind of magic. And he was suddenly better. So he had no place to go, so she said, can he come stay with us? And I'm like, sure. And the thing I liked most about him is he was crazy about me, and it didn't matter how I felt about him at all. But it turned out he wasn't done with that crack pipe. And I don't know about you, but it's hard for me to be with somebody who has a different buzz. And, you know, like if I was hanging out with my friends as a teenager and people are getting stoned and they're watching cartoons and I'm like, you're so stupid, you know, until I smoke some, then I'm like, you know, or you go to a kegger party and like three or four people go into the same bathroom stall and you're like three people just went in there and then they come out and they're all like, you know, they've got the Coke thing. They're like, hey, what's going on? I'm, until you're invited in. I remember my boyfriend going, what, babe? I didn't do anything. Until you get invited in, then it's not so creepy. So that's what happened with this guy. I couldn't break up with him. And I mean, that just wasn't even an option. So I started doing that with him. And I'm grateful for this experience now, not so much then, but within 6 months, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I live, fired from my job, and he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which went for about $20. And I had no place to go. And I went to live with my best friend's parents back in La Crescenta, where I was born and raised. And Diana and I grew up together. She was my best friend. We've been best friends since kindergarten. And her parents were like the families that I saw on TV. I spent a lot of time in front of the television. And they sat down and they ate dinner at the same time. And they talked about their days and they talked about plans for the future. And they loved each other. And so I always liked kind of being at their house. Not for too long though, because that's, you know, too square. But when I had no place to live, that's where they took me in, and I got to have that kind of sense of a family for a while. And Diana was living in San Diego. She and I had grown up together. We partied together. She grew out of it, moved to San Diego, was going to school, having a big life, and I continued to stay in La Crescenta, just circling the drain. And so her parents were very kind to me, and I knew I had a problem with drugs. I always knew that. I always would go through different phases with drugs and run my life into the ground, but there was always alcohol. But now things are really bad, but I still don't think it's the booze. So, but now every time I drink, I don't know how drunk I'm going to get. Maybe one drink, I'm hammered. Maybe 10, I don't feel it at all. But I do know as soon as I start drinking, I need to get party favors. And so one thing leads to the next. And so then I start trying to white knuckle it, because I'd been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for my friends who really needed it, but clearly I wasn't that bad. And so I, you know, keeping track on a calendar of my days, like I have a day and then I drink and then I'm, you know, and then I have to start over, and it was a lot of paperwork. And so one day I decided if I was going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. And I poured my first guilt-free drink. It was White Zin in the box. And I was sipping on that delicious beverage when the phone rang. And it was a guy who worked with Diana. His name was Jeff. And he'd been sober. And she'd been telling Jeff about her loser friend. And he called and he said, I got your number from Diana. I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat, and she said, Vince and I are going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come with us? And I did. I get goosebumps every time I share that, because a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. And I don't know how that could have happened. You know, when I try to imagine what God's grace is, I go to that moment. That's the moment. Because I qualified for this program so many times when I was sliding across my face in the quad when I was 13, you know, different points throughout my drinking, when I was hospitalized, you know, all these different times, but I wasn't done until I was done. And it was then, for whatever reason. And Pat and Vince took me to the big Wednesday night Pacific group meeting, which was different than any other meeting I'd been to. And people were happy and sober at the same time. And I was like, what's going on? You know, I didn't really trust that. And so Pat said she'd be my sponsor until I found one, and got me started on a really simple course of action, which was going to regular meetings on regular days, call her every day. So I start doing that. And she's like, okay, get commitments at those meetings. I'm like, okay. So I do that. And then I'm thinking, you know, I'm like already 25 years old. You know, I've wasted all this time. I've got to get moving. You know, I have got to get a great job. I should go to school. I should really get a good diet plan and exercise plan, and it's time for a relationship since I'm well. And luckily I shared that, and she too laughed at me, as you did. And so I was taught about getting a first-year foundation. All the time and energy you'd want to put into relationships, put that into AA. All the time and energy you'd want to put into going into school, put that into getting your steps done. Get a little job to go to in between meetings. Don't quit smoking. No major changes. And no relationship. I was like, what? I don't understand. So, but I had come up with the plan that I was going to try this one-year thing. And I was going to do everything that I was asked to do. And then when it didn't work, I could go back to my glamorous life. And luckily, I haven't had to do that. But I would take direction almost with that in mind, like, okay, I'll try that. That's really going to help. Okay. But then I would do it, and it would. I'd be like, oh! So what happened for me is I was about 2 weeks sober, and a family friend came forward and told me all these secrets that my mom and grandma had kept from me. And I knew it! I had been through all of their personal belongings over the years because I fancy myself a bit of a detective. And I looked through everything and I couldn't find the secret of me and why I was the way I was because it wasn't my fault. I knew that. I knew it was theirs. So I needed to find out why. But I never found the secrets I was looking for. And so now this family friend comes forward and tells me, I'm like, I knew it. So I write down all these secrets because when you hurt me, I like to be super specific when I throw it in your face. So I wrote down everything. But instead of taking it to my mom, which I was going to do, and throw it in her face and hurt her, I took it to Pat and I said, look at what I found out. I knew it. My favorite thing to say. And she said, it's so good you have that written down because you're going to need that later. I had no idea what she meant. And she said, but for now, I want you to work on being a good daughter and granddaughter. And I was like, what? Okay, first of all, I don't even know what that is. So we came up with a formula, and that's that I would call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. And if I were doing these things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I'd been a good daughter and granddaughter. And this was not for my mom and grandma. This was for me. This was so maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober. Because where my mom and grandma were concerned, I felt fierce love and loyalty and fear and blame and shame and all of these feelings all at the same time. Like there was so much angst around my mom and grandma, and I felt so much guilt and all of this stuff. So this was a way that I began to become free. And I did this out of order. I had to start making this living amends right away. And so I started sending the card once a week, which was so hard. I would get a card that already said something right, love Georgia. That's the best I could do. And then I started making a weekly call, and I had to have a topic because that was super awkward. And I used to only call when I was in trouble, like, I have no place to live, I have no money, talk to you soon. And then I wouldn't call for months. So every time the phone rang, they thought something was wrong. So I'd be like, hello? And so now they were still answering that way, but now I'm calling each week. So the calls got a little bit more mellow. And so I started picking up the pace on my cards because I go from being way less than to being grandiose really quickly. And so I'm like writing, now I'm writing about my adventures in sobriety, and I'm imagining how they must be savoring each of these cards, maybe in a beautiful decorative box or perhaps tied with a lovely ribbon. And maybe on a cold winter's night, they're pulling a card out and rereading it. Remember this one? Oh, that Georgie. So that's my fantasy of what's happening. But what's really happening, I found out. So I make the call to my mom. I'm like, hey, mom, calling to check in. And she goes, well, we got your card. But grandma's been having to white them out to reuse them. And we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil. So so I did. I wrote those cards in pencil until my grandma died, which was 12 years later. And the reason I did this is because I now had a sponsor who told me I could take all my problems to her and I'd never have to go through anything alone. And I was starting to have an experience of a higher power as the result of going through the steps with a sponsor. And I had all these friends that I never dreamed I could have. And I was starting to have this big life, and I had all of these tools that I never even knew existed before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it may not be fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility. And in this case, I had the most tools. So I wrote this damned cards and pencil for a while. I punished them for a while by writing a little bit less, which they didn't notice. I was going through some stuff like maybe a month ago, and I actually found one of the cards that I had sent to my grandma where she had erased my beautiful writing and then wrote, "Love, Grandma," and sent it right back to me. Whatever. So a really important lesson I learned in this was, what you do on your side of the street, none of my business. I'm only responsible for my side of the street. In fact, the dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. And in taking these loving actions toward my mom and grandma, I was experiencing love as I was doing this. So how they received it, what they did, none of my business. And so I began to love them more. The more I took loving actions, the more I felt love for them. And things started to change. Now, my mom and grandma also believed that they should never have to call me. A real phone call went like this. "Well, we wanted to call you. I mean, we wanted to wish you a happy birthday, but you didn't call us." And so I realized that on my birthday, I could do what I like to do, which is go, "I know they're not gonna call," looking at the answering machine, which just, if we had answering machines back then. "I know they're not gonna call, I know they're not gonna call," and then at the end of the day, say my favorite thing, "I knew it," and then be miserable. Or I was starting to learn I could do things differently, and I could, on my birthday, instead call them and say, "Today's my birthday, and I just wanna tell you I love you," and then enjoy the rest of my day. These are like crazy ideas. And all of the best things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous are contrary to what I thought. You know, it's just like, if you take what I really want to do and what I think and just flip it over, yeah, that's going to be better. And so that's what I started to do, just contrary actions, contrary actions. And so my relationship with them began to get better, and I went through the steps with my sponsor, and I made it to my first year. And in our group, we do a watch the night you turn one. So everybody gathers at a coffee shop, and they gather around your booth, and when it's 10 seconds to midnight, they go, 10, 9, 8, and then they sing happy birthday at midnight, and it's a big deal. And the only way you can have a watch is you have to go to watches so you don't sleep for a year. And so you really want to get through your watch. So there were like 200 people at my watch, and I couldn't believe it. And I knew everybody's name except for maybe one. And I couldn't believe how much my life had changed. And I kept that commitment to stay out of a relationship for a year and about an hour and a half. And so I take direction very literally. So I kept, I did that. And so then we were engaged 10 days later and married 6 months later. So, yeah. So I was married to him my first 5 years. And they were great years because we both stayed really close to AA. AA was always our priority. And when it didn't work out, surprise, we were both able to stay sober and stay in the same home group, which has been a great blessing. You know, I've never had to leave my home group because I feel uncomfortable. In fact, I've been told to show up no matter what. And so that's what I've done. And I was about 5 years sober when we split up, and I got involved with someone else right away. That's how I rolled in those days. And so things were going well. I had a great job. I loved this job. I was super active in AA. I'd learned to work a program at a very high velocity, like go, 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 24/7. Ah! Didn't sleep a lot, just service. I was taking classes. I was doing all these things that I wanted to do. And being of service was the biggest thing. I was starting to learn that love that I wanted, that emptiness that I felt so for so long that I was trying to fill with all this stuff, the only way to fill that is by giving. Feels good to get, but it never fills that emptiness. The only thing that ever fills that emptiness is giving. When I'm lonely, I have to pick up the phone. I have to take the action. There were people who loved me along the way, but I didn't even know it, you know, because I couldn't feel it. And so I was super active, and then I had to have a second back surgery in sobriety. I had minor surgery, but this time I had to have a spinal fusion. And they were going through the front, and which is a longer recovery, but it's better for your back in the long term. And so if all went well, it was going to be a 6-month ordeal. And so I made plans accordingly on that with my sponsor, like how are we going to handle this, meetings at my house, what I was going to do about work and all of that. But I ended up being in that like 1% where something goes wrong, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year, and I lost everything except my sobriety. My sponsor reminds me oftentimes when I'm going through a difficult time, she's like, "I don't worry about you. I know you can make it. The outside stuff doesn't matter. You've lived where you didn't have a place to live and you stayed sober." And I'm like, "Oh, right, okay." So I now go from a high velocity to complete stop. And I don't know how to work a program this way. I don't know what to do. And so I quickly learned that a way that I can be of service is to allow people to help me, which was so humbling. I mean, I had to have babysitters every day. I had to have people help me eat, dress, do everything. I had people bringing me meetings. I had people taking me to meetings, and I'd lay in the back. They'd bring in a beach chair, and I'd lay in the back of my meetings. And I had people helping me that I honestly wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with. And so I got to get to know people I never would. It's like when you're sharing a commitment with someone and you're like, oh, really? I'm going to share that commitment with him or whatever. And then you get to know the person and you're fast friends. And so I got to get to know people at this whole different level. And, you know, I look back at my life and I, you know, it always feels like in the moment, this time it's not going to work out. Something is going to go terribly wrong. But then I look back at my life and I see how beautifully orchestrated it's been up until this point. And that's one thing that comes with having some experience. When you're new, you kind of have to take our word for it. But once you have some experience of that, you know it like at a cellular level versus just having to have faith in someone else's story. And so I look back at the most difficult times of my life, at the seemingly bad, and they turn out to be some of the best times in my life, where I've laughed the hardest, and I've cried the hardest, and I felt the connection that I wanted so much my whole life. And so it was during that time I'm losing everything, and the guy that I was seeing came to me one day and said he'd consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well, and dumped me, and I was devastated. And so I called my wonderful sponsor. So Marilyn's been my sponsor the last 23 years. And I called her, and at the time she was learning to play guitar, so oftentimes I would call her, she'd be plucking away in the background. And which is kind of cool, you know, like, oh, this sounds like a third step issue. And so so I called her and I'm like, and now I got dumped. And she said, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression and sang my blues. And it made me laugh. Because by that time I had had the surgery, the complications, I couldn't work, I couldn't drive, I had to get rid of my car, I lost that great job, I couldn't pay my bills, I was borrowing money to pay my bills, I couldn't color my hair, I'm a little vain, so that was actually one of the bigger things. So, and now I get dumped. So she just really thought that that would make a good song. And so she put something together for me. And that's been a great gift in my sobriety too, is finding humor in everything. And I am so glad that I have a sponsor who finds so much humor in my most difficult times. And so, you know, I was so full of uselessness and self-pity at that time, and I can pray for a character defect to be removed, but what normally happens when I do that is an assignment appears, and in this case, the assignment appeared in the shape of a person named Mike Finch. And Mike was 34 years old, and he had Lou Gehrig's disease. And I watched him go from walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down. And but something that never changed about him was his joy. He loved AA. He used to say, there's no cure for ALS except for AA. And so he sponsored a ton of guys. And first he was driving up from Vegas to the big Wednesday night meeting. Then he moved to San Diego. And his wife had also left him when he was sick. And he was driving up from San Diego. And he was an attraction to me because he was so joyful. And, you know, I had something that was debilitating. I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is a disease of your sympathetic nervous system. And so what it can do is it can leave you paralyzed, or in the old days, they would amputate the affected limb. I was diagnosed really quickly because my doctor had had somebody before me. He didn't know what they had, and it took like a year to diagnose. So when I showed up after my surgery and it looked like I had a blood clot, it wasn't a blood clot, it was this weird disease that I then looked up on the internet. Don't do that. Don't. But so I'm having treatment for this new disease because you have to have you have to treat it aggressively. So I'm going to the hospital 3 times a week as I'm recovering from this back surgery, and I'm having cervical and lumbar punctures where they're going into my spine and they're giving me epidural blocks and they're freezing nerves, and it's 3 times a week and they're putting an IV in my leg. It's this whole gory thing. And I just, you know, my disease was debilitating, but it wasn't fatal, and Mike's was fatal. I mean, he was dying. And so he was such an attraction to me. So he and I became friends, and then we became more than friends, and I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him, which I probably, you know, wouldn't have chosen to love somebody that I knew was going to die. but it didn't really feel like I had a choice. And I'm grateful for that experience. I think when it comes to my emotions, and as an alcoholic or maybe just as a human being, I'm such a coward, when it comes to my emotions. But because of this program, it's given me this beautiful net with sponsorship and God and the meetings and all the tools we have here that I get to take these big leaps and I get to love big and I get to have my heart broken and I get to pursue dreams and I get to embarrass myself, and it doesn't break me anymore. It does not break me. And so I took this leap and fell in love with Mike, and in falling in love with him, I found something redeemable in me, because I didn't know I could take care of somebody like that, because I had always measured love in what I was getting. It was never what I was giving. It was always what I was receiving. And so this was a whole change in that, and I ended up moving down to San Diego to help take care of him. And we're taught when we're in an uncomfortable situation or we don't know what to do to find a commitment. And so I'd been reading about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross about death and dying, and she talked about photo journaling. And so I asked Mike if I could do that. So the last 6 months of his life, I took pictures every single day. So I have pictures of joyful times and people gathering, and then every time his dad would come to visit and leave, they'd have to say the big goodbye because they didn't know if he was going to die or not. So there's lots of pictures of his dad kneeling at his bedside, and then there's pictures of us going back and forth to the hospital with issues with his feeding tube and all these different things. But my most favorite picture, which I really can't show too many people, is he's on the commode, and he needed help doing like all of that. So he had a couple of the guys he sponsored. He's sitting there, and one of the guys he sponsors is sitting directly across from him, just so self-obsessed, going, me, I'm problem, just talking about himself. Then another guy he sponsors is sitting on the sink playing guitar. He's just like in his own world. And that's like one of my favorite pictures, because it encompasses that time. It's like, it was just real. It was unedited love and joy and sadness. And it was scary and it was beautiful. And I used to call Mike the Make-A-Wish boy, which I know is not very tasteful, but he had a really good sense of humor. But when you know you have a limited amount of time, you live differently. And so he did. And our house was filled with AA, and that was helping to take care of us. And I was able to walk through some stuff with my dad's death, because my dad died of cancer in our house. And so there was a lot of details about that I suffered with over the years. And I was able to kind of write some of those things with Mike, taking care of him. And over this period of time, my relationship with my mom had continued to get better. And about a month before Mike died, my grandma passed away. But by the time my grandma died, she turned into nice grandma. I don't know when it happened, but one day she started sending me like, Count Chocula, count 1 to 10 or whatever. Like, I'm in my 20s and she's sending me Sesame Street cards and these crazy things, and telling me she loves me, and just started to be nice. And I thought, okay, because I wanted people to believe the new me. I'm not the lying, cheating, drunken girl I used to be. So I guess grandma's not that mean lady anymore. And so she started to be nice. And I think it's like our disease ripples into the lives of the people we love. So does our recovery. And so by the time she died, I had a good relationship with her, and I was able to be there for my mom and be of emotional support. And then about a month later, Mike died, and his father and I were both holding his hand when he died. And that was an extraordinary privilege, and it doesn't always happen that way. And I see now that he was truly a man among men, because I have had a lot of experiences since that has shown me just that I have experiences that's given me more light on the situation and what a blessed time that was in my life. And so after Mike passed away, I moved back to LA. I still have chronic pain today, and I'll just say this, and we don't have to talk about it at all after the meeting or anything. If you have any suggestions, I'm good. But so today, it's not my first rodeo. Thank you, though. So the way I treat my chronic pain today is with Pilates and AA. And, we're not supposed to say our case is different if you suffer from chronic pain, but I'm here to tell you your case is different. But for me, it's not in the way that I wanted to hear. And for me, that means I have to do twice as much to feel half as good. And that I have to distract myself, and speaker meetings are a great way to do that. Speaker CDs, I stay really active. I got to the point where I was staying home and nursing my pain. I'm in pain. And the pain was getting bigger and bigger. And my sponsor would say, well, when you stay home from the meetings, are you in pain? And I would say, And she'd say, well, then why don't you come to the meeting and be in pain, and at least you can take care of your spiritual condition. I'd be like, oh, you're so mean and you don't understand. But she was right. So I realized I could spend my life in pain, thinking about the pain, not living, or I could just live my life, and when I need to sit down or lay down, do it. Boom. And now I have this big life, and the bigger my life got, the less the pain got. I don't know why. But anyway, I moved back to LA, and it was really hard for me to get back into the swing of things, and my grandma had died, and so my mom asked to see me, and I had not found it necessary to throw those secrets in her face all those years. And so I drove up to Cambria, which is where my grandma lived. And I used to hate Cambria as a kid because I was trapped in my grandma's crazy house filled with smoke and brown TV. And then once I got older and I started looking outside, I'm like, this place is heaven. Oh my gosh, I love Cambria so much. But so my mom lived here and died here in 2004. But so my mom asked me to come see her, and I did. I was back in LA. I got a little job, was getting back into the flow of things, and she said that she was waiting for my grandma to be gone to tell me some of the things that she needed to tell me. She didn't know that I had heard all these secrets, and the secrets that I had heard were that my mom and dad were not really married, that my dad was an alcoholic and a womanizer, that he had had a child with one of the neighbors, and that they were raising it as their own, that my mom had embezzled the money that my dad left me when he died. And so those were the secrets that I had heard. But what my mom did is she sat down and told me her story, and that was that at 8 years old, my grandma's family couldn't take care of both my grandma and my grandma's sister, so they sent my grandma at 8 years old to live with another family, and she never went to another day of school, and she cooked and cleaned, and was physically and sexually abused in that house. And the way she got out of that is she got pregnant with my mom at 18, married a man she didn't love, and by the time my mom was born, she'd already left that man. And then she started my mom on that same routine, living with other people, staying in boarding schools, forgetting her over the summers. And my mom yearned to be with her mother, and so she ended up living with her dad and her stepmom, but always wanted to be with my grandma. My grandma would show up in her fancy car, Magia, and fancy jewelry and furs, which were okay at that time. They weren't like this now. It was never okay, okay? But anyway. So she would show up, and my mom's like, ooh, shiny objects, you know, it looks like fun. And so when she was given the choice, she went to live with my grandma, and it turned out that my grandma had turned to a life of racketeering and prostitution. And so my grandma was a madam, and she was running this place in the Mojave Desert, and so she turned my mom out to work the family business when my mom was 15. My mom never went to another day of school. She had children that she put up for adoption at 15 and 16, and then after that went another route for the many, many more that she would have had. And until she was 38 and then had me. But the story she told me, the abuse that she encountered, she had no friendly direction. She had nobody who loved her. There was nobody that she trusted in her life. She couldn't trust my grandma. She couldn't trust the men that were coming into the house. She couldn't, the church that had taken her in as a child turned their back on her because now she was this wicked woman. And I couldn't believe that this was my mom's story, because I had only seen my mom as this depressed, angry, lonely person. And I never imagined that her life could have been that. And I spent my whole life being mad at her for not giving me what I thought I deserved, which was love and direction. If she'd only, you know, had me in music classes or dance classes or taught me that I could go to college, or then my life would have been different. But these are things that she didn't have to give. I thought she had them and withheld them from me because I was unworthy. But it wasn't that I was unworthy, it's that she didn't have them to give, and she gave me everything she could. And I think about it sometimes today, like, one of the reasons I get asked to talk is because the story of recovery with my mom. And it's almost like this is a gift that she's given me. I wouldn't have been able to travel like I do and do the things that I would do had I not had my mom's story to tell in this unique way. So it's kind of it's a crazy thing. I've got to wrap up. But I was able to, I fell in love with my mom after that in a whole different way. I realized that she really was my hero, that the life I had was the life of a princess compared to the life that my mom and my grandma had and I could have had. And so I was so grateful I'd taken those actions, even though I didn't believe in them, because she was amazing. And so I just began to have this fierce crush on her. And I had already learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and my girlfriends, and I got to get to know her, and she was fabulous, and she was so funny. She was 75 years old. She was dying of cancer. It was lung cancer, and then it went to her bones and to her brain, and we went to the hospital for yet some other test. I don't even know why at that point. And the x-ray technician came out, and my mom said, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" So good. This is good stuff. And I would have missed it all had I followed the well-meaning suggestions of friends who talk about setting boundaries and confronting, you know, but in AA I was taught about love and tolerance and about taking care of my side of the street. And she died, and that was really a difficult time. I miss her every day still, but I'm grateful for the time that we had together and for what I was taught here. And today my life is really good. Next to getting sober, the best thing that's happened to me is that I work in Skid Row. I work at the Midnight Mission, where I get to take all the love and hope I get in these rooms to Skid Row every day. And, you know, music has always been really cathartic to me, and I've always found singing really cathartic. Not so much for my audiences, as it turns out. So, this was a source of great pain for me because it was my passion. I mean, from a kid to, I mean, I've taken classes, I've done a lot of stuff for fun and for free, but you get what you pay for. And so, but it was a source of pain, like, follow your passion. No, I suck. Like, why would God instill this passion in me and then have me suck at it? And so I felt like it was a cruel twist of fate in my life. So I start working at the Midnight Mission, and so I started a music program there where I bring musicians to play for our homeless community. And so what I've come to find out about those passions and desires is that they're there not for the reason I think. Maybe it's not for me to shine, but for it to shine through me. And so so that's been a shift. And then I'll close and just saying that my relationships are different today. I had always been looking for somebody to complete me. We were talking about this on the way up here, that you know, such a romantic notion, you complete me. But what that means is, without you, I'm incomplete. Now you're responsible for my happiness, and you're not going to be able to keep me happy, and it's not going to be pretty. And so today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and this wonderful program, I am complete. And so the relationships in my life enhance my life, and hopefully I do the same for the people in my life. And I'm so grateful. Thank you.